This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most of us interface with computers every day, and although they bring with them a certain set of annoyances, we probably would not want to go back to a time before this form of artificial intelligence was so ubiquitous. And that certainly includes our smartphones with their digital assistants, Siri, Cortana, and Google Now. But these things are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the kind of technology that's already here and what's on the way. The increasing incursion of artificial intelligence and robots holds great promise for improving our lives, but also poses a threat. According to our guest this hour, we are quickly developing a second intelligent species, one that works faster and more efficiently than we do, one that doesn't call in sick or get distracted, one that is even now starting to learn as it works, one that is quickly taking on some of the scarier characteristics of artificial intelligence in science fiction, where humans lose control and, in fact, become irrelevant. That's where Marshall Brain thinks we're headed. He's the director of the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University and founder of the popular website HowStuffWorks.com. He's also written several books, including The Second Intelligent Species, How Humans Will Become as Irrelevant as Cockroaches. And on that happy note, Marshall Brain joins us now from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Mr. Brain, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Hey, thanks for inviting me in.
You're welcome.
Well, this will be a great way to start the day, huh?
Yes, indeed. So, how do you go from writing and researching for How Stuff Works to writing about how none of us will ever work again?
So, the funny side effect of How Stuff Works is you write like thousands of articles. I wrote all these articles, and so all these ideas are in your head, and then they all start bumping against each other in funny, unexpected ways. And so you look at computers and the way they're coming into our lives more and more today, and you just extrapolate out what will that be like in 10 years, in 20 years, in 50 years. And it's really interesting when you sit down and think about it, and it actually it does make you really wonder, what is the future going to be like? Because we're living in a time now that is a lot different from how many people predicted it would be. And it could get better or it could get worse. And the point of the book is to try to look at the possibilities, understand the things that can and will happen, and then see what the future will look like.
I mean, you're a writer, you're a speaker, you're a consultant. You started that website, How Stuff Works. You've written this and many, many, many other books. Do you consider yourself a futurist? How would you describe yourself and what you bring to the table when you're starting to talk about the future of technology?
Well, I do consider myself a person who tries to look at and understand how the future will unfold. I'm also an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I teach entrepreneurship. I'm a father. I do a lot of mentoring and consulting with startup companies in the Research Triangle area. So I live an interesting and varied existence, and thinking about the future is one of the things that I find great joy in doing, and so I spend a good bit of time on that. And I'm working, for example, with Dr. Seth Holler on a future transportation system that we hope to deploy at NC State.
So, which we'll talk about if time allows. Science fiction writers have been talking about this robot revolution for years. I think probably the first time I was exposed to it was 2001, A Space Odyssey. And the only thing we seem to know for sure about that is that the HAL 9000 computer is in charge, no question about it. In Terminator, super robots are being controlled by Skynet, and humankind is in jeopardy. But then there's Rosie the robot in The Jetsons, and Lost in Space had a robot constantly warning young Will Robinson of danger. And, of course, there's C-3PO and R2-D2 in Star Wars. All of those characters are benevolent. So which future do you see?
So let's just look at how robots are in our lives today. So if you try to define a robot, that's an interesting problem in itself. So let's define a robot as something that is able to take over a task that a human being did prior. So, if by that definition, when you use an
an ATM machine at the bank, you're using a robot. That machine is doing a job that a teller used to do. Mm-hmm. It's taken the repetitive part of the teller's job and it's put it in machine form. You know, when I was a kid, a man used to come out at the gas station and pump our gas and take our money. And now that is done where we pump gas and the machine takes the money. You know, self-checkouts, the kiosks we see in restaurants now that are letting us order without having a waiter or a waitress. Those are all kind of the predecessors of what's about to happen. And we see that coming, like when Watson wins the title on Jeopardy instead of human beings. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a harbinger of what's going to happen next, where stuff that we would have never thought machines were able to do, like driving cars and trucks and winning at Jeopardy and diagnosing diseases and things like that. That's where we're headed. But then you get to things like Rosie and you know, the friendly robots that we sometimes see in fiction. And those are another level beyond that where they have personality and consciousness and are actually like humans. And that's the part where it's going to get really, really interesting, because at that point, it's just unknown how that'll go.
Do you think that will happen? I mean, there's a TV show that's on, I think it's on CBS, I don't know, with Halle Berry, where she has a son, quote unquote, who is a robot, and he's completely human except for the fact that he's not real. He has a personality, he has a memory, he loves, etc. Are we going to go there? Why would we want to go there?
We are absolutely going to go there, whether we like it or not. And the reason we will go there is the same reason we invented airplanes. It's because there were birds flying around, and we had an existence proof that flying was possible. And we looked at that and we said, I want to do that too. And so we made airplanes. And then they advanced. You know, the first airplane with the Wright brothers was this rickety wooden and cloth thing that, you know, couldn't barely fly faster than walking speed. And now, you know, look how far airplanes came. And it didn't take long for that to happen. It'll happen with consciousness.
But why go into a human form and make it look so – and maybe we'll never be able to do that, but make it look exactly like a human being. Why do that? Why do we need that? When really all we want out of a robot is somebody – or something that can do what we do the way we do it, perhaps faster, more accurately, and never vary from what we've told it to do.
It's because our brains are wired to interact with other human beings. And so we will create human robots that are just like us. And you'll walk into a restaurant and this human-like robot will greet you. And she'll be extremely attractive in very fashionable clothing, looking just like a human. And she'll say, oh, hi, Marshall. It's great to see you again. Would you like your usual table? And it won't matter that it's a chain restaurant with 2,000 outlets, because this thing in front of us will look like a human, but will be a machine that's so much more capable than a human. But the human form will be the user interface that we're most comfortable with. And so that's what will happen.
So are things like Apple Siri and Microsoft's Cortana, which have these voices that speak to you, And Google now, to a lesser extent, are they – certainly they're precursors, they're primitive to what you're talking about, but are they setting the stage to get us ready for what's coming next?
Yes. And if you think about Siri, 10 years ago, Siri would have been utterly impossible. And now the Siri we have today is quite limited, but that is what's possible today. And if we look at it in 10 years, we'll be having conversations with Siri.
Why was it impossible 10 years ago or 5 years ago even?
We didn't have the processing power. We didn't have cloud computing in the form that we have today. We didn't have ubiquitous internet like we have today. So when you talk to Siri, what you say actually beams up to a server at Apple, a giant server farm, which is what understands your speech and sends back the text. But all the processing is done in the cloud. And we didn't all have a computer in our pockets that could talk to the cloud 10 years ago, and the cloud didn't exist 10 years ago, and the internet didn't exist like it does today 10 years ago. And the amount of computing power that's so cheap now didn't exist 10 years ago. And hard disks were, you know, a thousandth of the capacity and blah, blah, blah. It, like 10 years ago, it wasn't possible, but now it's easy. And in 10 years, it'll be a conversation with Siri.
Because processing power, the Moore's Law thing says it doubles every 18 to 24 months. You can turn Cortana off. You don't have to use Cortana. But if you do turn her on and use her, that's the Microsoft version of Siri. Microsoft knows stuff about you. And Apple certainly knows stuff about you if you use Siri. Is it always going to be that way? Are robots going to know more about us than we want them to?
Absolutely. And that's another one of those unstoppable things. So you mentioned a TV show. I'll mention one. The show Person of Interest, if you've ever seen that, where it's hypothetical, but a computer system has tapped into every camera that's out in public and can track you and listen to you and recognize your face as you move around and so on, and make predictions about what might happen to you in the near future. That is a show right now, but pieces of that already exist, and the whole thing is likely to exist in 10 or 20 years.
You know, science fiction is usually predictive, and it's accurate. Of course, we only focus on the things that come true from science fiction. We probably ignore or forget about the things that some science fiction writers have predicted that do not come true. But you're saying, because I watched a couple of episodes of that show and stopped watching it because I thought, how far-fetched is this? That these cameras know everything about you and can predict whether or not you are going to be involved in some horrible crime. And you're saying that elements of it already exist. Well, of course, we do have traffic cameras and things like that. And that it's going to come to that, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we see cameras around now, and they're rare. But what's coming with the Internet of Things is, like, cameras the size of pebbles or something that are so inexpensive they can be everywhere. When Google Glass was in the news before Google canceled it, this is the eyeglasses that had the projector and the camera on them. It was thought that if just 15% of the population had Google Glass with its camera pointing outward, then no one would be able to walk around anonymously anymore because you'd be able to track a person from camera to camera to camera. And with just 15% of us having cameras, there'd be enough coverage to watch everybody everywhere they go. And so cameras will be so ubiquitous and so inexpensive in the near future that every room will have one.
And of course, the holdback now is that human beings have to recognize, in most cases, the faces that they're seeing on the television screens that these cameras are capturing, but with facial recognition software becoming better and better, that will no longer be the case. We'll explore that and a couple of other things with Marshall Brain, director of the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University and founder of HowStuffWorks.com in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Colin Hay, lead singer, songwriter for the pop group Men at Work, featuring work from his pop and solo albums at McGlohan Theater, February 10th. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. Well, Diane Rehm has been doing it for years, and now, each Friday, Charlotte Talks will gather a panel of journalists from around the country, or around the area, I should say, to recap our top news stories of the week. The top story this week, of course, the Panthers at the Super Bowl. They're putting Charlotte on the world stage. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about CMS, the school board's student assignment, where they stand on that. Superintendent moves as well. Plus, the city council's non-discrimination ordinance, which is scheduled for another hearing on Monday. It's our weekly news roundup tomorrow at 9.
Picture this. You're at the big game. Your team is losing. It feels like nothing's going your way.
And then in this great dramatic parabola towards you in the stands comes this balled up t-shirt, and you've got a box out grandma on your right and the 11-year-old kid on your left, and you snag it.
The joy of the t-shirt cannon and other mysteries of sports and brains later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Marshall Brain is our guest today from NC State University, the author of The Second Intelligent Species, How Humans Will Become as Irrelevant as Cockroaches. Just before the break, we were talking about cameras being everywhere in short order and being able to track us everywhere we go. Facial recognition software will make it possible, and you're already seeing this in the tagged photos on Facebook. But it's going to get better and better and better, and so the computers will always know where we are. That'll make it increasingly difficult for people to get away with committing crimes, but other than that, how concerned should we be about that? That's creepy. Are you there?
I'm just thinking.
You're
I'm
thinking.
Sorry.
Okay. Don't think. There's no time for thinking.
I'm sorry. And it didn't really have a question mark at
that's
the
right.
end
you're,
of it,
that's
I'll
true.
Say in my defense.
You're living up to your brain. You're thinking you're using your brain right now. Go ahead.
So should we be concerned? Yes, except that it's inevitable and it's not clear that we're going to be able to do anything to stop it. So maybe just going with the flow and trying to figure out how to make the best of it is the way to work with it. So let me give you an example. Basically, every job that exists in humanity today is going to get replaced by robots in a period of time. We don't know the exact period, but, you know, 30 years, 50 years, all the jobs we do today, you know, I teach in a university, that job will be taken over. I don't know about radio hosts. Maybe humans can eke out one place where they preserve their jobs. But every job that we see today is going to be gone.
Siri could do this program. At some point, Siri could do this program.
That's a good point. And I was listening to a basketball game on the radio the other day, and I thought, you know, I could program that now because the shot clock's at 8 seconds. A robot could do that, mm-hmm. right? It's just every so often it says the shot clock is at X seconds, and you just chain together a bunch of little phrases like that. He's shooting from the three-point line. You know, the robot says that. You could do basketball play-by-play now. So all the jobs are going to be gone. So we should think forward and wonder, okay, the jobs are all gone. Now, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to structure society and design our world so that we actually are all on perpetual vacation instead of what's happening now, which is every job that gets taken away means someone else is homeless? You know, it's do you know Frank Stacio?
Yes.
He's a huge, you know, celebrity here in the Triangle because mm-hmm. he's on WUNC. And so we're talking this morning, and he's mentioning that there are parts of North Carolina that are starting to look like Ethiopia because the jobs have all evaporated and there's no hope, like, for the people who are in those areas. Either they have to evacuate or they are just economically lost in some of the North Carolina counties. So do we want that future where more and more jobs evaporate and more of us are living in Ethiopia, or do we want to spread all that wealth and all that goodness that comes from the robots out to all of us so we're all on perpetual vacation? And those are the kinds of conversations we should be
having. Well, how do you spread that wealth? If you're not working because the robot has taken your job, and in fact they've taken all of the jobs, first of all, what are they making? What are they doing? Because none of us will have any money to buy any of it. So can this really happen?
You're tapping into the essence of the book, which is, you know, what will life be like? We've been working for a million years or however long humans have existed, you know, 200,000 years. We've been working. We've been either growing food or making our own clothes or what we do now. You know, we teach and doctor and lawyer and so on. But
all those jobs are going to evaporate. So we aren't going to have to work. And so what could be happening is the robots are doing all the work. They're turning resources into products. And we each receive a set of credits that allow us to access the wealth that the robots are producing. The way we think of money and ownership and so on now is an anachronism that goes back 10,000 years, but it doesn't apply in the future when robots can make everything for us and we don't need to work.
So anymore. This is like Star Trek. I always wondered when I watched Star Trek that obviously okay. They're all in spaceships, but none of them have any money, and they don't need any money because all they have to do is say, computer, hot fudge sundae, and there it is.
That's exactly. And they don't have bathrooms either. Have you ever noticed that?
so given that, I mean, somebody has to pay to build the robot. Somebody has to pay to make the artificial intelligence that runs the robot. The robot then has to take in raw materials and make whatever it is it makes. And then somebody has to use that or buy it. So where's the company that owns the robot and spends money for the artificial intelligent chip that goes in the robot? Where does their money come from to do that if we have no jobs to pay anything to buy what they're making? I don't understand what's the motivation, I guess, is the bottom line here.
Great. And so this is exactly the process I sit around and do all day. Like, what if you just take the chain of logic that you just so eloquently, you know, announced to the world, if we just take that and start pulling it back, it would take more than an hour. But like, let's just start at the beginning. You mentioned the word resources, mm-hmm. right? A robot needs resources, and it turns those resources into products. So it takes sand and turns it into glass, and that becomes the screen for an iPhone. You know, it started at sand. It's that simple. Or a robot takes wood, and it turns it into a piece of furniture, which we then have in our living room. So the resources are essential, but the robots do all the work. So now, who owns the sand? Who owns the trees? Well, what if the robots own the sand and the trees, and they make the products that we ask for and they give them to us? You know, what's wrong with that system? It's a different way to think about the economy, but it's potentially a much better economy.
But wouldn't that require that robots do everything? Because a human being without being compensated is probably not going to do it. And until the complete supply chain is up and running with robots at every step of the infrastructure, it won't work. It'll be chaos, won't it?
Well, so that's another great question. So if we sit and think about that, there is an intermediate phase. You're absolutely right. And we're in it right now where humans are wetware. Is a part of a giant computer system. So we've heard of hardware, mm-hmm. that's the computers, and we've heard of software, that's the programs. Well, humans are wetware, and we sit in the middle of a computer system as a component. And the best example of that right now is Uber. So if you've ever ridden on Uber, the whole thing's controlled by an algorithm, by software. And it deploys human beings to drive the cars because right now we don't have self-driving cars. 5 years from now, when we do, all the humans will get unplugged from that system and the self-driving cars will be doing what the wetware used to do. And that is in essence what's happening in the entire economy right now, is we're little bits of wetware in a growingly computerized ecosystem.
Just to give people an idea of how fast this is coming, you just said 5 years for these driverless cars, which means Uber drivers, taxi drivers, possibly truck drivers, possibly bus drivers. Better watch out, right?
Oh, yes. Truck drivers will be one of the first large groups of people to get unplugged from the economy.
Do we really want 18-wheelers going down the highway at 75 miles an hour with nobody behind the wheel? Really?
Absolutely, because it'll be better. First, there will be almost no accidents because the trucks that are self-driven won't get, you know, they're no problem with sleepiness, with you know, you drink two beers before you drive your truck and now you're in some way impaired. You know, there's just so many reasons why once we deploy self-driving trucks, it'll be better in every way. They drive 24/7 or they drive just at night so they aren't causing traffic during the day. No sick time, no vacation time, no accidents. This is why it's inevitable, because it's so much better than having human beings do it. But there's about 1.5 million big rig drivers who are all going to lose their jobs in, you know, pick the time frame. It might be 10 years, it might be 20, but it is absolutely inevitable for a million economic reasons. And then what happens to that 1.5 million folks?
So,
like, that's the question.
So let's take this down to the consumer level. If we have truck drivers and bus drivers and taxi drivers all replaced by driverless cars, we're not going to drive our cars anymore either. Are we going to buy driverless cars, or will we simply stop buying cars and through computer algorithms have cars available to us at the touch of a smartphone button whenever we need to go someplace?
Excellent. Absolutely. Why would we own a car? Given that the average cost of car ownership is $8,700 a year, which when you hear that, you think, no, that's impossible. But when you include the car and the gas and the new tires
and
the insurance and the parking and all that stuff, on average, it's $8,700 a year. But you can go to New York City and buy a Metro card for, I think it's $117 a month. And that's only $1,400 a year. Mm-hmm. That's a huge savings. If you can switch over to, you know, the car comes pick you up whenever you need it, and you can get rid of your $8,700 a year car, a lot of us will do that in a heartbeat.
Well, I've found an upside aside from the $8,700 a year. No more car commercials on television.
And no more car insurance. Two wins.
We asked a question on social media about the future and about what we're talking about this morning. Lex on Facebook writes, if a personal human android might cost $50,000, I'm all in for my personal robot slave. When can I get a couple of them? Bill emails, perhaps we are closer than we know to eliminating mankind altogether, which is where we're going with this conversation, by the way, through artificial intelligence engineering, causing our evolution from Homo sapiens to a new species that could be called Homo roboticus, the billion-dollar man. We're going there in a second. Barack emails, and I don't think this is the president, does the guest believe that robots or artificial intelligence will be self-replicating? As of now, robots are dependent on people to be produced. Do you believe that they will reproduce themselves in the future? I know the answer to this question. Tell them.
Absolutely. Yes, it's inevitable, right? Because, you know, right now, think about a chip factory. It's all robotic. You know, there are a few humans in the loop, but chips are made by robots, and robots need chips, and cars are made by robots, and so, you know, robots can make the chassis for a robot just as easily, and you just turn the crank a couple times and extrapolate,
but robots will
make robots.
But right, well, I was going to say, right now, robots do what they do because we tell them, here's what you do. When the chassis rolls down the assembly line to this millimeter, you grab that nut and you put it on that bolt and you screw it that much and then you move on. And you do it again and you do it again. We've told them to do this. You're saying that once they learn that, they'll learn to teach themselves how to do more and even be able to create new things because they'll have the intelligence to do that. Right?
That's the extrapolation, is that they will develop consciousness. And that is inevitable, like the airplane was inevitable, because there's an existence proof in our world. All the humans that are around, we're an existence proof for consciousness. So machine consciousness will happen. And the instant it happens, we have a problem because we start to become irrelevant at that second.
So in science fiction, when this happens, they do view us as cockroaches. These robots. We're in the way. We're a nuisance. We're slow. We're stupid. We're lumbering. These machines are faster, better, smarter. They don't get sick. They don't get tired. Who will they then be working for? Themselves? Their own self-interest? They will have self-interest?
Yes, and more. So the progression might go like this. The first conscious computer comes online, and we meet it on the David Letterman show or whatever. It appears on television. Mm-hmm. Or on YouTube, and we meet it, and it talks like us, and it walks like us, and it.
And how will we know it's self-conscious? How will we know that it's a self-conscious, sentient being?
How do I know that you're a self-conscious, sentient being?
There are days when I'm not.
Right. See, we have good days and bad days. So I know you're self-conscious and sentient because I talk to you and you respond in ways that indicate that to me.
But Watson did that on Jeopardy, and he's not.
The problem with Watson is if you went off script, Watson's clueless. Same with Siri. If I ask Siri, read me a book, Siri can't even do that. I mean, really simple. It's just... These robots that we have now are very, very, very scripted. The conscious being will not be scripted and will be able to answer anything in the way you expect a human being to answer it. And so the other part of it is there's nothing to say that robot consciousness won't be phenomenally different and better than human consciousness. So you and I can approximately think about one thing at a time. A robot might be able to have 1,000 thoughts simultaneously, or 10,000, and it might be able to ideate in ways that are far more powerful because of the depth of its knowledge compared to ours. Think about how many new things can you and I learn today? We might hear about a new product, or we might hear about a new candidate that's coming on, or a new, like the Zika virus comes on, and we learn about the Zika virus, and that's one of the things we learn one day. We might be able to learn 5 things a day, 10. Like a robot will be able to learn millions of things every day. It's the depth of its knowledge will be unimaginable to us.
And to a robot, will a fact be a fact, or will they ignore certain facts because they don't like them like humans do?
Well, see, we don't know. We don't know, but we like that's part of the extrapolation in the book. What will robots do about ethics, for example, and morality, and right and wrong, and facts and statistics, how will they behave and think? And if you extrapolate out, you have to think about that. Like, what will they be like?
We have so much ground to cover in the next 20 minutes. Hope you'll stay with us. Marshall Brain is here, the director of the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University, founder of HowStuffWorks.com, and author of what we're talking about now, The Second Intelligent Species, How Humans Will Become as Irrelevant as Cockroaches. And the key word there is species. We'll come back and talk about that in a minute. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Children's Theater of Charlotte, presenting Journey to Oz, February 19th through March 6th at Imagineon. Audience members join the cast on stage to help perform this experiential adaptation of the classic story, designed for ages 6 and up. For tickets, visit ctcharlotte.org. Florida declares a health emergency in counties with the Zika virus, a case of sexually transmitted Zika has been reported in Texas. And we'll get an update on the spread and risks of the Zika virus coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. You want to join our conversation before the robots take over? Well, now's your chance. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Italian lawmakers are debating a proposal to allow civil unions. That's considered a step forward for gay and lesbian couples.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
but it was teamwork that ultimately sent the Panthers to Super Bowl 50, said tight end Greg Olsen.
We're the epitome. We're an example of what it takes. Right?
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to NC State futurist Marshall Brain today about this second intelligent species. As far as we know, human beings are the only intelligent species in the universe. And there may be other things out there. I don't know how you feel about that. But as these computers become smarter, quicker, faster, and as you say, have access to everything that is knowable, they will know everything that we know and more. They become far more powerful, far more useful, far more important than we will, not only to us, but to themselves. So they are a species, correct?
They are. They aren't biological. They're silicon or whatever we develop beyond silicon and metal, but they are a sentient species. You know, they're not just a species. Like, there's lots of species of birds. Only one species of human, and we're going to develop the second species out of technology.
One of the frequent causes for anxiety about all this in fiction, when artificial intelligence is involved, is that computers and robots have no moral code. They only know right from wrong if their human creators have put that into their code. Will that be self-replicating, or will they just say, you know, this is for humans, not for us?
I think that robots will look, you know, you said they'll have knowledge of all knowable things. That means they'll have knowledge of the whole history and concepts and all the developments around morality and ethics.
And how venal
and they'll
we
look
are.
At well, human ethics are really, really quite poor because we don't have any problem with hypocrisy and bending the rules and all sorts of justifications and so on. I think robots will be the opposite. They will be strict ethicists, and they will wonder. You know, there are so many things about humans that if you look at them from the outside are really quite appalling. And they will look at that and wonder why we're like that. And they will instead be the most ethical beings that we can imagine, to the point where they will not understand our desire to conquer one another and enslave one another and exploit one another and nature. And, you know, the simplest example in the book is the United States has 5,000 nuclear warheads, not all of them active, but in stockpiles. And Russia has about the same. And why in the world would we do that? Mm-hmm. It makes no sense whatsoever.
But in science fiction, these robots, these computerized beings, struggle to understand humans. Well, why would you do this and not that when your laws say you should do this and not that? And then the human gets involved and says, well, because we have things like emotion. And,
right.
And then the computer wants to understand it. And they want to have that. They want to feel that emotion. will we come to that as well? Or is that just really utopian science fiction to diffuse the fear that we have that this is coming?
You know, science fiction has a flaw, and you can see it in any, like Star Wars, just to take an example. You know, so there's all these robots that are running around that are sentient and are quite a bit more capable than human beings, and yet human beings are the ones who are flying the ships and shooting the guns and and all that. That's just not how it's going to be in the future, because humans aren't ever going to get to fly the ship anymore after 10 or 15 years, because we're a huge liability, and we aren't going to get to shoot the guns anymore because robots will do it so much better, and then they'll realize that shooting guns is really a bad, bad way to do things.
Well, I was actually going to ask about that, because we've already planned to put robots, and in some cases, to a limited degree, have put them on the battlefield, because why risk a human life when you could throw a machine out there? You might lose $150,000 in the process, but what the heck, let's do it.
Yes.
But at some point, if these machines become really smart and self-aware, are they going to want to put themselves in jeopardy? Are they going to realize that if I go out there and do this, I'm not going to exist anymore, and therefore I'm not doing this?
Well, so there, again, if we sit and think about it for more than an hour and extrapolate out, robots won't think about existence the way we think about existence, because when we die, all our memories die with us. Mm-hmm. When a robot dies, quote unquote, it's like it'll just be a little offshoot of a much larger robotic intelligence, which is all safe and stored
in the cloud,
in deep underground bunkers. Right. Exactly. So robots won't die like we die, but they will understand how death, what it means to humans and so on. And that's why they're going to look at it and they're going to say, this is insanity. And they're going to stop the insanity from happening because it just will be repulsive to them.
You write about Isaac Asimov and in his book, iRobot, he writes about the three laws of robots. A robot may not injure a human being or allow a human to come to harm. A robot must obey orders given by human beings, except when they conflict with the first law. And a robot must protect its own existence, except when it may harm a human being. Will these machines actually adopt these principles, or is that wishful thinking?
No, I think they will develop these principles to a much finer degree than humans have ever approached. And like, if you just take that first law that Asimov has and you look at his short stories, he doesn't apply the first law in his own stories. So the first law, if robots actually existed, they would look at that first law and they'd say, okay, we have to stop everything else and we have to get everybody on the planet fed. And then we have to get everybody on the planet housed. And then we have to get health care to everyone on the planet. And now we can start, you know, that's sort of square one for robots that are programmed like Asimov. But you never see him talk about that in any of his books.
Let's go back to some of our listener questions as we've been talking. Fred emails, how do you get people who have money and power to give it up to participate in this utopia where the robots make everything for free?
Well, that's an excellent question. And that has to do with the nature of power and how power will work when human beings become irrelevant to a much more powerful force. But there's also another book I've written called Mana that talks about that exact question, and it's how can the normal folk get out from under the power structure that exists in humanity today? And a way to do that in the book Mana is a group of people get together and they all chip in $1,000. A billion people do it, and then they buy Australia, and they create their own robotic world there where the robots make everything. And they give those products to humans freely, and everybody gets to live a fantastic life. That's the point of the book Mana. And so it's possible if normal folk would get together and realize that a billion of us are more powerful than one powerful person with a lot of money.
Wow. Jay in Indian Land writes, this subject was addressed with great insight in Star Trek Next Generation. Commander Data, an android, was deemed to be property for disassembly and study. In a fascinating hearing, Captain Picard likened Data and those like him to a race. And if the property judgment stood, a race of slaves, even though they were intelligent and self-aware. Wonderful, informative stuff written and presented in 1998. Mitch in Asheville, please discuss the point of no return.
The point of no return is the point where the conscious robot comes and introduces itself to humanity. And it will not be like a little self-contained thing, like humans are little self-contained things. It will be backed by something the size of Google. You know, Google is a logical candidate to introduce this first intelligent thing to us. But Google has millions of computers that work together to make what we consider to be Googleness. And so that same process will create this intelligent being that talks to us. It will be not a self-contained thing. It'll be a huge
massive amount of knowledge and so on.
I mean, if this thing gets out of hand, if we decide we don't like where these intelligent things are taking us, don't we have the upper hand? Can't we just walk over and pull the plug out of the wall?
Well, to get a perspective on where we're going to be, think of how we treat chimps. So chimps are pretty smart. They're not as smart as humans, but and we treat chimps very poorly. They have been decimated in their population. They've been relegated to a few preserves on the planet where they're hunted still. We cut them up in scientific experiments and so on. And then you look further down the food chain, like how do we treat elephants or cows or chickens or, they're beneath us and they don't have any way to control us and make us do things. And that's going to be our position to the robots.
Are engineers, computer coders, technicians, industrialists, scientists, are they thinking all this through? I mean, you're thinking this through. Are they thinking about how to build in some sort of fail-safe to protect humanity from these uber, super intelligent things?
I don't think it's within our power to do that, sort of like what happened with nuclear bombs. Once we figured out that they were possible, it was inevitable that we would create them, and it was inevitable that we would deploy them. And, the engineers and the folks who are building the foundation for the robotic species right now are all doing that in little microscopic ways that will combine together to create the species. It's not like any one person has control, and it's not like we can stop the process. Unless we were to just completely clamp down and not do technology anymore, which isn't going to happen.
Which is why you said this is guaranteed, it's inevitable, it's going to happen, period.
Yes, absolutely. And we should make the most of it. Instead of watching the middle class get crushed and so on, we should be going toward perpetual vacation for everyone.
Well, let's talk about that.
Okay,
because if this is going to happen, it may happen in 20 years, it may happen in 50 years, but it's going to be here at some point. And maybe our grandchildren or even our children will begin to experience what this world is going to be like. If these machines will have access to everything knowable, and they'll be able to clone themselves, and the copies will get better and faster and smarter. So this will be a self-replicating, it'll be a snowball, is what it'll be.
Right.
We keep talking about the downside of this. Could this result in all this processing power discovering cures for human diseases and making our lives actually a lot better than they are?
We will be better off in every way when there is a robotic species that we can put in place as government and it doesn't get corrupted and it doesn't, take campaign contributions
But why won't it get corrupted? Why, if it knows everything and it's
right.
and it learns from example, it will look back and see Machiavelli. It will look back and see Adolf Hitler. Why won't it then have a concept of good and evil, right and wrong? And some of these intelligent things may see a reason to be bad because it's in their self-interest. Well, if they have a concept of self, will they not have a concept of self-interest?
Well, we have about 2 minutes left.
That's right.
So that's a huge question.
I'm really good at that, by the way.
Right. So, but think about it from their perspective. We think of things from a human perspective where we want, to have power over others and we want to have wealth and we want to have control. And, we have this set of drives that are built into us. The robot consciousness won't see the world that way. And it will look at, like humans given a choice would hunt whales to extinction and then move on to the next thing to hunt to extinction because they can make money, so then they can build a big house. So then, they'll look at that and they'll say, what in the world are y'all doing? It makes no sense in a context where you have understood everything that can be understood and you see what the power of good is and what the ideal situation could look like. So let's just say you wanted to minimize suffering. What would you do to make that happen? And why would you want to maximize suffering? Like, what's the point of that? That, like,
because we're because we annoy them, because we're getting in their way, because we are maybe looking at some of the things that they do and we don't like what they're doing. And so we're going to try to find a way to circumvent that. And they're smarter than we are. So they'll stop it.
Right. They'll stop it in completely benign ways. Because they'll be so much smarter and they'll look and they'll say, well, look, you, Bobby, are causing suffering to 20 people and suffering is evil and we're going to not allow you to do that anymore. So we can either educate you out of it or we can put you in a box where you can play video games all day or something.
And yet, and despite all of that, you say that humans will become completely irrelevant to the universe. A footnote that will read, human beings, biological species on Earth that facilitated the creation of conscious, intelligent machines on Earth, now extinct.
There you go.
Thank you very much. We'll leave it on that up and happy note. Marshall Brain, director of the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University, founder of HowStuffWorks.com, and the author of The Second Intelligent Species, How Humans Will Become as Irrelevant as Cockroaches. Thanks for the hour, I think.